Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, I'm joined by Olivia Lang to talk about writers and drinking on the trip to Echo Spring. Olivia Lang's first book, To the River, was Book of the Year in the Evening Standard, Independent and Financial Times, and was shortlisted for the Royal Society of Literature Hondarti Prize and the Dolman Travel Book of the Year. Olivia is the former Deputy Books Editor of The Observer and writes for a variety of publications, including The Observer, A New Statesman, Guardian and The Times Literary Supplement. She's a 2011 MacDowell Fellow and has received awards from the Arts Council and the Authors Foundation. And her latest book, which we're going to be talking about in this interview, is The Trip to Echo Spring on Writers and Drinking. So, Olivia, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me, first of all.
Pleasure.
I want you to describe what this book is, because it's sort of a melange of a number of things. It's a travel book, it's literary criticism, it's a close look at a number of writers. But how would you describe it?
I think it's an investigation, really, into quite a deep level investigation into both why writers drink, what effect drinking has had on writers, but also what effect the alcoholism of so many of the 20th century's greatest writers has had on literature, whether that matters, whether that effect can be noticed. It's really a sort of desire to understand alcoholism as a disease through literature and to see the effects that alcoholism has had on literature.
Is there a distinction then? I mean, is this a book about writers who drink or alcoholics who happen to write?
Well, that's a good question, isn't it? I suppose that's the question. They're absolutely alcoholics. They're not people who drink casually. And it's a book that's absolutely about alcoholism rather than sort of a more social kind of drinking. And it's really sort of driven by that question of a desire to understand alcoholism by way of what I suppose is they're the most eloquent people who have ever had alcoholism. They're the most eloquent sufferers there have ever been. It's not, I think, that writers are more affected. Perhaps they are, perhaps they aren't. But I don't think they're particularly more affected than firemen or teachers. Mm-hmm. The reason I wanted to look at them was, of everybody, these are the people who are going to be able to lay down as clearly as possible, not necessarily as honestly, because often they're not particularly honest about it, but with as much detail as possible. These are, if I wanted to understand the disease, these were the people I wanted to go to.
This idea of the sort of romantic idea of the alcoholic writer, the writer who drinks. I mean, I guess some of these writers that you talk about really personify that. They invented that concept. You know, that, it obviously there were writers that drank before, a lot of writers that drank before them. But at the same time, some of them, when we get on to talking about some of the people you chose, they almost invented that idea. And I wonder if to what extent they, it's sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, they sort of perpetuate the idea that, you know, they became writers, they were drinkers, but at the same time there's this image of a writer drinking, which means they're going to keep drinking.
I think who we're talking about here is Fitzgerald and Hemingway, and I think they invent almost, and especially Hemingway, a model of American masculinity that is very much about lifestyle. So they're sitting at their typewriter, they're writing their words, but at the same time, they're people who live on a very large scale. They're people who really eat up the world, and part of that is their ability to drink, part of the sort of partying side, the pleasure-taking side, which is very important in Prohibition America. You know, there's this whole sort of puritanical strand, and these are people who are resisting that. So that's part of why drinking, I think, becomes so glamorous. And the other thing is that it's so much tied up with masculinity, that they're people who, again, especially Hemingway, who... they're doing this sort of sensitive, delicate job, and at the same time they want to look like a big butch guy. So there's all the shooting, there's all of the fishing, there's all of the kind of boxing, punching rivals' noses, and drinking is a part of that. It's like, I can drink you under the table, and I will drink you under the table. I can be the powerful drunk, the powerful drinker, in fact, not the person who gets drunk. And you see a lot of that in Hemingway's rivalry with Fitzgerald, is that he's always saying, hey, he's a lush. I, on the other hand, check it out, I can drink bottles and bottles and, you know, I'm not falling over.
You've mentioned a couple of times there the idea of masculinity, and all six of the writers you've chosen to talk about are men. Now, there are plenty of drunk women writers around at the same time that you could have chosen. Is there a reason? Is this idea of... Again, I guess there's a, as in so many areas of life, a sort of stupid double standard... in that this idea of the romantic drunk writer is a masculine thing, and women drunks are held to a different standard to the men.
I finally just wrote a piece for The Guardian a couple of weeks ago about alcohol and women writers, because it's the question I always get asked, is there a difference? And the stories were fascinating. You know, I was looking at people like Patricia Highsmith, Marguerite Duras, Jean Rhys, and their drinking is so different. It's so much more considered shameful. They're so much more harshly judged by society and by their peers. Whereas Hemingway, really, people were emulating him, copying him. I think especially, and this is very much a 20th century story, I think especially with the women, it's a much darker, bleaker story. This one turns out pretty dark and bleak for the individuals.
As we'll get on to.
It retains this glamour to this day. And I don't think anyone thinks about sort of Jean Rhys getting drunk in her bungalow and stabbing her neighbour with a pair of scissors. They're like, hey, that's a Vogue shoot in itself. I mean, it isn't, is it? It seems...
No, but I could think of somebody like... I mean, I guess, you know, again, in later life, Dorothy Parker is the exact example I was going to come out with, who
has
a much
more... And she's the equivalent to Hemingway, I think. Yeah. She's the one who sort of managed to make that look good. But we're talking about Dorothy Parker at a very particular moment in her life.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, again, it's sort of... when somebody's holding the drink, it looks great, but later on, really not so much.
And we're talking about it, we've got to get in really early on, you know, we're talking about it as a romantic idea. But, I mean, all six of the people you talk about, and we've named a couple, we'll name the rest in a bit, but it's not glamorous. I mean, they're having a good time in some respects, some of them. I think there's this glamorous idea, you know, this idea that they're, you know, they're out partying all the time, especially when we look at somebody like Fitzgerald, you know, it's all parties, it's all glamour and money. Their lives actually, when you examine them, are, and, you know, I don't want to sound judgmental, but grim and sordid, and none of them seem, they're not nice people, none of them seem like particularly great people to hang around with once the drink has worn off.
And I think even actually once a session has got stuck into, if you have somebody like Fitzgerald, sure, he's kind of hilarious for a while, and then he starts taking your watch and boiling up in some soup, and he's taking his pants off, and you're like, Fitzgerald, please stop taking your... You know, it gets out of control. And you see this, if you're reading the letters, especially between friends, his friends will be just saying, Fitz, you're such a great guy, stop it, just stop drinking like that. So I think there is a sense of, if the drinking is at a certain moment, it can make somebody very fun to be around, it can look very glamorous, but it's something that escalates, it's something that gets out of control, and particularly for these people who are alcoholics, it becomes something very different very fast.
So very generally, and obviously with the caveat that everybody has their own individual reason, alcoholics drink because they need to drink. Why do writers drink? What is it about drink that is attractive to the writer?
Well, the question, I can answer that in terms of these people. Perhaps this is true on a wider level, perhaps not, but what I was noticing with them all, and I hadn't known much about their childhoods in advance, so I hadn't picked them based on these similarities. This is something that sort of emerged through research, but they tended to be shy, socially anxious, awkward kids. They had not particularly happy upbringings. they kind of suffered. They were not especially happy. And for almost all of them, there's this pivotal moment where they discover there is this substance, and if you drink it, magically, all of that dissolves. And I mean, somebody like Tennessee Williams, who I'm sure we'll talk about more, but would suffer from unbelievable amounts of social anxiety. So when he first found that if he had a cocktail or two, that would go away and he could speak to people at ease, that was an extraordinary discovery for him. The link between that and writing is so tricky to get at, but it seemed to me that it was something to do with a desire for escapism. All of them were little boys with a gift for telling stories. You know, they weren't very popular, people didn't really like them, but sometimes they could just sit down and start telling a story to their classmates, and people would get caught up in it. People would just be drawn into this spell. And I think that sort of desire to be somewhere else than the unhappy circumstance in which they found themselves lies somewhere behind. I don't want to make it too sort of crude an explanation, but it lies somewhere behind both the drinking and the choice of fiction as a career.
I'm Jeff Dyer, you're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
How does that then feed into the writing itself? So drinking for social confidence, and I guess once these people, some of them have obviously more success than others, but are having more and more success, so therefore are being thrust into the public gaze more and more, and no doubt the drink helps with that.
Yeah.
To what extent does it help with the writing? Again, it's a question that it's difficult to answer because we don't know how it would have turned out if they weren't drinking. But
possibly better. I mean, what's interesting is people always assume that they're drinking to write, that they get drunk in order to write their pages. And perhaps that's true of somebody like Charles Bukowski, but of all these writers, not at all. They weren't getting drunk at the beginning of a day's session. They were drinking at the end in order sometimes to relieve the pressures. Hemingway in particular will talk about at the end of a day, he wants to change the tune. You know, as at the end of any sort of day, you think, right now I'll have my beer. But also, the huge pressures in particular of a writer's life, I think, are that you're in isolation for a long time and then you're subject to unbelievable scrutiny based on your work. And I think as the fame builds, and somebody like both Tennessee Williams and Hemingway in particular found this, the scrutiny becomes unbearable. The criticism can be incredibly personal and hostile. And I think that's where drinking starts to take a role in the working writer's life, is it's a way just of losing yourself, of hiding from that. And that, I think, is a point where it starts becoming very dangerous.
The other thing, of course, with alcoholics is the trail of destruction and broken relationships and, you know, damaged friendships that they leave behind them as well. So again, if we can talk about this romantic idea that the writers we're talking about needed drink, not only just to cope, but in some ways to propel their work, to give them something to write about. That's an interesting idea, but is the price of that too high?
The price is brutal, I think, and the stories are brutal. So you'll just see so many marriages going south, relationships with children in particular becoming absolutely poisoned, and that's always heartbreaking to read about. That's often very painful. But when you're weighing it up against, well, is it worth it because it allowed this literature, I think actually that's a false sort of equation, because I'm not sure that the drinking facilitated the books. Perhaps sometimes it gave, you know, little scenarios that somebody could write down, and certainly with somebody like Raymond Carver, you see that he's writing down almost everything that happened. So, yeah, perhaps you'd lose some of those stories, but it's a very hard equation. I always feel when I'm asked that, like, it's kind of up to the kids to make that. Only they know whether it was worth it or not, really.
At least, well, definitely two of the six writers that we're talking about, their life ends in suicide. Yeah. It's debatable the extent to which the other people perhaps, you know, drank themselves to death. I wonder to what extent are we talking here about, you know, obviously alcoholism, but to what example does just, you know, their mental health play into the thing as well? So are we talking about writers that drink because they're writers, or writers with mental health issues that drink because they have mental health issues and just happen to be writers as well. I mean, why does this? Why does it end up leading to these brilliant people taking their lives so often?
I think there's some incredible combination of sort of vulnerability and talent, and it's really hard to say exactly what causes that or how the different factors play in, but all of these people suffered from depression. Often there's a genetic component, mm-hmm. or at least a nurture component, that you can see that there were family members, particularly fathers, who also suffered from depression. So out of the two suicides, it's interesting, John Berryman and Ernest Hemingway, both their fathers killed themselves. Both their fathers suffered from profound depression. So these sort of things get handed down. There's obviously a lot of stuff about anxiety as well. But on top of that, I think alcoholism creates its own problems. So once you're really stuck into that sort of addictive relationship with alcohol, you're then almost automatically, you're lying, you're cheating, you're stealing, you're breaking promises, you can't fulfil your contracts, your work is suffering. So that's sort of creating its own, not necessarily mental illness, but a state of emotional disarray. And the whole thing is kind of escalating and escalating, which I think is why these stories tend to end up in such dark places. And the physical effects of this poison, you're taking on this poison in huge amounts. And so really the miracle is that anyone ever gets out of it, rather than that so many end up in death, because I think that's kind of the trajectory.
Well, one of the ways that people often get out of it, which is featured quite heavily throughout the book as well, is Alcoholics Anonymous, which a number of these people benefit from. AA itself is something that's, you know, is quite controversial. How did the people we're talking about here benefit from it?
I think I'll just say something maybe more personal than that, which is that first, which is that I had no sort of AA agenda when I started writing the book. I probably would have said exactly what you just said. And I went to an AA meeting in New York right at the beginning, and what really struck me and what I hadn't known was the sense of fellowship that once people recover, they stick around, they carry on going to meetings, not just in order to look after their own recovery, but to extend the fellowship to other people, to help other alcoholics. And at that meeting, there'd be people, they do their AA sobriety birthday, so they'd be talking about, you know, I've been sober for a week now, or I've been sober for a month. And there'd be people saying, I've been sober for 22 years. And that just blew my mind, that people will come and will sort of want to share that, want to extend that onward. So that idea of the simplest core of AA, I guess, I found very inspiring. And I think that is really what saved both John Cheever and Raymond Carver, was the idea of faith in AA, that you can do it, people do it. God only knows how. Nobody I spoke to seemed to know really how it works. But there's something about if you stick to it, if you believe in this sort of mysterious process and just stop drinking, just stop in any given moment, without really particularly thinking about what extends out past that, it works. And God knows that, you know, it sounds like a sort of cult, but it has saved so many lives. So I came away really very impressed by it.
The other side then of that is, I mean, to what extent is the milieu that these writers are in, as I said, especially the ones that got some sort of notoriety, some sort of fame, to what extent is that, are they enabled by that lifestyle, I guess?
What, by the lifestyle of drinking?
Yeah, I mean, I think perhaps this is more of a modern thing, although perhaps somebody like Fitzgerald, to what extent were they almost expected to live up to that standard?
Yeah, like a kind of Amy Winehouse sort of.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I've never actually thought that so directly as you've just put it, but I think that there's probably some truth in that, that you start getting caught up in a character and expected to behave in a certain way. And I think when you get descriptions of the sort of later Hemingway as well, you definitely get the feeling of there's a person inside there almost looking out through a mask of the myth of Hemingway, and perhaps very much sort of caught up in this feeling of this is how I should be behaving. And yeah, that's interesting. And especially because the alcohol is having such strong effects on the brain and the emotions, and people become more and more vulnerable, I guess it then becomes almost a prop that I just play the character. And there's an amazing New Yorker profile with Ernest Hemingway by Lillian Ross. It's quite famous, and it was done sort of well into his late stage. And he's almost like a caricature of himself, how he's talking. He talks about himself in the third person throughout. And you do get the feeling of somebody who has just really drunk their own Kool-Aid, you know, who's just fallen in love with their own myth. and yet isn't very happy inside it either. So it's really quite disturbing to read.
I'm thinking also of, you took in the book about the YouTube clip of Tennessee Williams, which is wonderful.
I love that.
I mean, it is great. I watched it over and over again once it was mentioned. But again, he is, you know, this ultimately drunk man making a fool of himself on stage, and yet it's treated so affectionately.
The thing I think that's different about that is that there's clearly, from David Frost, this huge homophobia, and it's a period where you could expect the audience to also have that homophobia, and Tennessee Williams just fronts it out. It's like, well, you know, you're not going to make me feel ashamed. And I think that's what the audience is responding to more than, like, hey, look at this drunk clown, is... I always feel very strongly about Tennessee Williams because I think, despite everything else about him, how brave he was about his sexuality sort of almost sets him aside from the rest. I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about him more, but I think in that moment you really see that he isn't going to be made ashamed.
Listening to Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny, and today I'm talking to Olivia Lang, and we're talking about her book, The Trip to Echo Spring, on writers and drinking. Olivia, all the way through this book, as well as talking about the writers, there's another narrative, which is your own story, your own journey, both metaphorically and literally, because you take a road trip across America. Basically, you travel to find some sort of trace of these writers, places they visited, places they live. But also, this is a story about your own personal journey. So tell us about that, first of all.
Yeah, I grew up in an alcoholic family, and I mean, that was really the impetus for writing the book in the first place, was when I was, I guess, 17 or so, I read Cat on a Hot Tin Roof by Tennessee Williams, and it was the first time I'd ever encountered alcoholism on the page. I'd ever encountered really a representation of the kind of life, the kind of family, the kind of home that I'd been inside externally, and it really blew my mind to find that. So I was really interested from then on in what do writers have to say about drinking. And then once I started realising that lots of those writers were drunks themselves, that sort of became a really fascinating subject. So I knew when I was starting to write the book that I wanted to not go into vast detail about my upbringing. I didn't want to write a memoir, but it wouldn't really have made sense as a book, as an investigation, if I hadn't kind of laid down my cards and said, okay, I'm personally interested in this subject, really strongly interested in this subject. So I tried to sort of, as minimally as possible, tell some of that story of what had been going on. And it was unbelievably hard. It was really... I ended up writing a lot of the book in New York because it was actually... The whole thing about an alcoholic family is that there's this thing about denial, that you have to keep the secrets. You can't tell anyone what's happening. You can't really tell yourself what's happening. And trying to break that taboo, you know, 20 years later as an adult, was really tough. So I'd be sitting in coffee shops in the East Village, kind of forcing myself to type, and these really are quite minimal scenes, but they were frightening scenes, and I was frightened as a child a lot, and that was hard to do. But I think it really is important in the book to just say, you know, I know what those rooms are like, I know what those places are like, I know what it's like to be around somebody who is that out of control. I've seen it.
I think it always brings it back to that as well. We talked in the first part of the show about possibly an issue of over-romanticising the idea of the writer who drinks. And what's so great about the book is you do constantly rein that in, because you will, you know, relate some horrible tale from your own childhood.
Yeah. And I really wanted to, you know, to not glamorise, but at the same time, I didn't want to sort of make them out to be sleazy or be cruel or be unkind. So it was really important that it was writers who I really loved, and to be able to sort of move back and forth between those moments of kind of revealing darker stuff, but then remembering all the time, like, He wrote some of the best books we've ever had.
So let's talk about the actual journey, the trip. So
yeah.
Why did you decide to write it in that format? Why did you want to go and visit the places?
I think stuff happens in places. It stops things being abstract, actually going to the places where people lived. It also, touching on what I just said, of wanting to try and sort of remember what was best about them, they were people who, all six of them, who were incredibly responsive to landscape in their writing and in their lives, and it seemed like a way of sort of remembering that, of catching at that kind of better side of them, as well as talking about what they were doing in bars or with a bottle of whiskey on the couch. And the other thing was that I really wanted to organise the book in terms of the sort of trajectory of alcoholism. So I wanted to look at intoxication and then at drinking really kind of getting out of control, and then these sort of these stories of the suicide, the worst of the drinking stories, and then recovery. And it seemed to me that I could sort of plot that out across the American landscape and physically travel through it, and that might just make it more exciting, more pleasurable for the reader.
There's times when you're immersed in a place. So the obvious one is New Orleans, you know, when you're talking about Tennessee Williams, and the fetid atmosphere of the place comes off the page, you know. I mean, it really adds something to the descriptions to actually be there, definitely. Let's talk about the first... Well, actually, I want to talk about two of the first three writers, because not that long ago I did a whole programme about Fitzgerald, so we can probably skip over Fitzgerald a little bit. But the first three writers that you talk about in the book are Scott Fitzgerald, Ernest Hemingway and Tennessee Williams. And I might have sort of imagined this a little bit myself, put this emphasis on them, but I think these three, they're obviously the bigger names, the more famous, the more glamorous. And I think in some respects, of course, Hemingway ends up shooting himself in the head one day. He's a tortured figure as well.
Yeah.
But they're also the three that they seem to be having... They've all got their problems, but I don't know. I'm trying to say they all seem to be having a better time of it than the writers will talk about in the third part, perhaps.
That's interesting. I probably wouldn't have separated them out like that, but I can see what you're saying. There was a period... You know, they were like big time fun guys.
Yeah,
liked to party. So I think there's truth in that. But I think also Tennessee Williams in particular had such an incredibly unhappy time for the last 20 years of his life. But yeah, they're large figures.
So let's talk about Hemingway. You've mentioned already his... I just want to talk about his background a little, because you've already hinted at this in the first part. But there almost seems some sort of destiny in Hemingway's story.
Yeah, he's so interesting. So he's kind of the kid from Oak Park, Chicago, and he had a very controlling mother, and all of those the Nick Adams stories, his wonderful short stories, are basically autobiographical. They're very, very close to his life. So his father was a doctor, and you see that character in the Nick Adams stories. And the thing that always gets said is his mother dressed him as a girl for quite a long time. So perhaps there's something there about why he became so incredibly butch and that shit, but perhaps not. But anyway, he emerged from this childhood. He was kind of a sensitive guy, a sensitive guy in glasses. And at the same time, he was this sort of raving bully with this great desire to kill things. There's this amazing story about him not only catching sharks, but machine gunning sharks, and machine gunning his own initials into the heads of dead sharks, which is like really taking things to extremes. He always took things to extremes. He's that kind of character, and sort of barreling from relationship to relationship, marriage to marriage, but with this incredible insecurity underneath it all, and this sort of desire to be loved and taken care of, and just such a complicated man, such a difficult figure.
So where does the drinking fit in?
I think the drinking really gets underway when he's in Europe, and part of that is the escape from Prohibition America, where there's such sort of Puritanism, and he reaches Europe. He goes to Europe really quite young, and he lives in France and he lives in Spain, and there's this totally different culture, and he falls in love with it, this sort of good living. And I think the thing with him is it gets out of control. He's always talking about how to be a good drinker, and that it's about sort of pleasure but moderation, but he doesn't follow his own guidelines. He isn't capable of drinking like that. So it just gets out of control. It's a greed, I think. And you can really see that in some of his stories and some of his novels, this incredible greed for more and more and more brandy and more Chateau Margaux, and uncontrollable.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Molly Oldfield, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Now, this is what I want to get onto next, really, how it filters into his work, really. How does Hemingway's, not just the drinking, but the entire, you know, the thing, the writer, he's more than any of the others, I think, is this model for not even just the drinking writer, but just the male, big sort of alpha male writer figure that we can later see in, you know, people like Norman Mailer, and, you know, are very obviously out of the same sort of mould of as Ernest Hemingway. So how does that come out in his work?
I think there are different phases. So I think initially he uses alcohol, as Fitzgerald does, as this sort of great modernist slippery thing that you can have these wonderful drunk scenes, and it can be very sort of technically elegant and interesting. But I think later what you see in his work about drinking, and I mean, his work is saturated with alcohol. I can't remember if I tell this anecdote in the book or not, but at one point my dad and I were on holiday together and he was reading The Sun Also Rises, and he decided to underline each time alcohol was mentioned. And you just look at the book now and it's like every page is covered in scribbles. So it's sort of there almost as a character in his work. But the thing that happens by the late stuff, so something like Across the River and Into the Trees, is that you can see that he's losing control, that he's losing control of his material, that he's losing that beautiful, clean Hemingway sentence. It's all over the place. It's bloated. It's not focused in the same way. It has become very similar to its author. And that's really sad. That's the thing that I think is really sad about Hemingway's drinking, never mind the fact that he's completely haunted by paranoia and in physical agony and et cetera, et cetera.
And I think also you talk about a movable feast, and I think to what extent is, you know, his bitterness and the way he portrays other people and the way he portrays Scott Fitzgerald particularly is something that perhaps, but I don't know, again, it's speculation, but might he not have done if he wasn't a drunk? Do you know what I mean? To what extent does his own lifestyle dictate the way that he describes his milieu and the way he talks about other people? You mentioned before about, you know, he has this ongoing thing about Fitzgerald not being able to hold his drink and being he's a proper drunk, whereas, you know, Hemingway's a drinker, whereas Fitzgerald is a lush.
Yeah, and what's fascinating about A Moveable Feast is it was the, I was so stunned by this, but it was the only time that Hemingway ever actually had to deal with how much he was drinking. He'd been to see a doctor in Spain, he discovered that he had alcoholic liver disease, and he was put on a diet so he couldn't drink at that point. And, you know, he's writing this book that's all very sort of cocky about his drinking, but actually he's also writing letters at the same time to Archie McNeice and various friends saying, Archie McLeish, not McNeice, saying, you know, wine is the thing I've always loved. I never thought they could take it away from me, and they have, and I'm terrified, and another 3 hours till I'm allowed my half glass. You know, so he kind of knew in some part of himself that he was dependent, and yet he's writing this sort of fiction of telling these nasty stories about Fitzgerald being a fool on a glass of wine and him drinking 7 bottles and being utterly fine, but he isn't fine. He knows he's not fine.
And we've already mentioned this, but let's talk about where this all ends up. To what extent, I wondered, can the end of Hemingway be put down to the drinking?
Oh, I think a lot of it. I mean, there's a theory now that part of what happens to Hemingway, part of the sort of crushing depression and paranoia that happens at the end of his life, is to do with concussion. He had these two or three really awful concussions. One of them, he was in an aircraft crash and he had to use his head as a battering ram to get the door open. So, you know, he really did sustain quite considerable damage to his head. And I mean, that's one of zillions of accidents. He was very, very accident prone. But I think there's really no doubt as well that some of it was alcoholic brain damage, and some of it was just the depression that was the driver for the alcoholism in the first place. This is what I mean about it being so complicated. But I think very much alcoholism is a part of why he ends up shooting himself. And that's just so sad. What happens to him seems to me to be a really one of the sad stories of the book.
So let's move on to Tennessee Williams then. You've already again mentioned this, you've already hinted at this, but there's also this other layer to Tennessee Williams' story, which is not only the writer, someone with absolute crushing social anxiety, someone with a drinking problem, but someone who's also having to cope in that era of America with his sexuality as well.
And what's amazing about him, and when we come to talk about John Cheever, it's really interesting to compare the two, because John Cheever's sexuality was a source of torment to him. I've read Tennessee Williams, almost everything by him, including his vast diaries. He never seems particularly tormented by his sexuality. He's tormented by so much else. But that seems to have been very sort of simple for him. That was what he desired. He was a very, very public figure. And all of these people, all of these film stars, all of these producers, the whole sort of circle that he moved in, which is kind of socialites and really quite a glamorous circle, totally accepted that he and his partner Frank Merlo were lovers, that they were together, they socialised together. There wasn't this sort of secrecy that you'd see with somebody like Liberace. There was just a total confidence about it. And I think that's why, out of all of them, Tennessee Williams has always been the one that I've kind of been most affectionate about, because it seems like in all these other ways that he was sort of duplicitous or unpleasant, he maintained that kind of essential honesty that is so brave in that era. Is so staggeringly brave.
The relationship that you paint the picture.
Although, yeah, that relationship has complexities.
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to say, because it is, I mean, it sounds like an amazing story, their relationship. It lasts for decades. And,
yeah,
you
know, and then it sours.
They're dependent on each other. But yeah, it sours. And it sours again, we're back to the drink. It
because,
really
absolutely
sours
because
of the
drinking. Yeah, because he becomes, I'm trying to think of a word that I can use on radio. He doesn't become a very nice man, let's say. And Frank, who by all accounts was an incredibly nice man, sort of tolerates this for a long time. But there's something that really happens with alcoholics, which is that they just lose contact with reality. They become very irrational. And there are lots of these sort of very irrational fights. And then Frank gets very ill. He has cancer, and in some ways sort of Tennessee cares for him, but in other ways he's very erratic. And, you know, it's this really heartbreaking story. And then Frank dies. And that, I think, is the point for Tennessee Williams where there's no going back, that he has now lost the person that he loves. What else is he going to do but just keep on and on drinking? Mm-hmm. So he called the 60s his stoned age. And when you read his diaries, it's just, I took a red pill, I took 3 green pills, I had a martini, I had a bottle of brandy, I had a bottle of rum. I mean, just staggering consumption. He's just gone. But the other thing that's extraordinary about him is that he's still writing plays every day. He's working. And this sort of work ethic perpetuate. So he's a very complicated man, I think.
But he goes through, in terms of his work, I mean, the obvious person to compare him to here would have been Fitzgerald, who we've not really talked about, but he has, you know, amazing, incredible, high success early on.
Yeah.
And then, basically, failure after failure after failure, really ignominious failure all the way to the end of his career, really.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. Those late plays are really being revisited now. A lot of them are starting to be staged again, and critics are starting to look at them in different ways, which is kind of great and kind of... I'm never sure the ones that... I haven't read them all because there are an awful lot of them, but I've read a lot of them, and they seem to me to bear the mark of the kind of drinking that he was doing, and to be quite sloppy and quite incoherent, and to sort of repeat things that had worked for him earlier on and get more and more sort of violent and strange. But at the same time, even taking out sort of two-thirds of his body of work, we're still left with this extraordinary... Mm-hmm. To my mind, he's the greatest American playwright that there's been, and when you kind of factor in the consumption, it seems like a miracle.
This is Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Olivia Lang, and we're talking about her book, The Trip to Echo Spring, on writers and drinking. It just occurred to me, Olivia, before we move on to the next three writers, that we've just finished off talking about Tennessee Williams, but we've not actually mentioned where the book's title comes from. Perhaps we should do.
Oh, yes, let's. So, The Trip to Echo Spring is in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Brick, who's the drunkard, the ex-football player, his wife, Maggie the Cat, is constantly saying, "Where are you going, Brick? What are you doing?" And he'll say, "I'm making a little short trip to Echo Spring," which partly means he's going to the liquor cabinet, Echo Spring, in the kind of bourbon, which I finally got hold of recently. quite hard to buy. But he is also talking about something kind of symbolic, this place where he calls it the click in his head, where things go quiet. So it seemed like the ideal title for sort of trying to understand what the deeper registers of alcoholism were. What is this? What does it mean to be making that trip? What is that place?
It also sounds like a supermarket bottle of New World Wine as well. Go get a bottle of Echo Spring from the convenience store.
Yeah, it totally does.
So the next three writers, John Berryman, John Cheever, Raymond Carver, I think they're well-known names, but they're not in the same magnitude as the three people that we talked about in the second part. In some respects, they're, for a lot of their lives, toiling away in obscurity. And so I think battling with demons, battling with alcoholism and failure at the same time, in some respects.
Actually, that's interesting. It's never occurred to me, but the first three are people who really found fame very, very young. And these three, yeah, I'd never made that comparison. That's totally true.
So let's... John Berryman, I think, I want to talk about most, really, because he's the one I was least familiar with.
I think that's true of everyone.
Yeah, I think... So why...
Including me, actually.
So why him?
Well, I was... the rest are people I've been familiar with for a very long time. They're sort of part of my canonical writers, you know, the writers that I've really loved, that I've grown up with. But when I was first thinking about the book, I was talking to a friend who's actually an academic here in Cambridge, and he said, "Oh, you must include John Berryman." And I sort of looked blank and went, "Who? No idea who that is." And he sketched out a little bit of the Berryman story, and I went away and I read the Dream Songs. So John Berryman is a poet, and his main, most famous piece of work is called the Dream Songs. And they're this incredible collection of sort of confessional sonnets of a character that's sort of him and sort of isn't him, called Henry. And at some point during the sequence, Henry kills himself, and some of them are from the other side, and they're extraordinary. They're really extraordinary. And I think as soon as I sort of encountered that voice, which is so much bound up with alcoholism, pain, suffering, all of these sort of themes, I realised that he had to be part of it.
And so Let's talk about what he was doing, because he was, you know, he was an academic. He wasn't, you know, a big famous star. So let's talk about how the writing and the drinking would factor into the just a normal, actually quite suburban, mundane life that he was living.
Although, that said, I mean, we don't know of him so well now, but he really was the campus poet. So in his heyday, he won a Pulitzer, and he was on the cover of Life magazine. He was famous mm-hmm. to ordinary people. He was like Robert Lowell or somebody like that. In an era where poetry was kind of glamorous, he had that sort of rock star cachet. So not initially at all. So initially he's this very, very nervous academic, very brilliant, writing really quite tight, tense poetry. And his friends, there's an amazing book by his first wife called Poets in Their Youth, and his friends were sort of Delmar Schwartz and Robert Lowell and this crew of people who all were totally tormented mm-hmm. and drinking like crazy, drinking like fishes, and sleeping with each other's wives, and this really sort of quite incestuous, quite painful society. And Berryman's actually interesting, although I said earlier that they tended not to drink to stimulate creativity, it seems like when he was really having his breakthrough poem, which is Homage to Mistress Radstreet, he was doing a lot of drinking, either to sort of coax it along or to calm himself down, because he was in such a state. I mean, he's the sort of person who would do a day's teaching, walk home in such a highly strung state that he'd go through the door of his house mm-hmm. and faint. He would just pass out. I mean, he really was overwrought. And apparently an incredible teacher, absolutely extraordinary, breathtaking mm-hmm. teacher. But also, once his alcoholism really got out of control, he would call up students drunk and threaten to kill them. He'd seduce students. He behaved very badly as well. And he's kind of this fascinating figure, particularly because he was very interested in his own alcoholism. He wrote this unfinished novel called Recovery, which was about his mm-hmm. journeys through the recovery process. And it's very closely observed. It's very funny. He could often be absolutely hilarious as well, which you don't sort of expect mm-hmm. from that kind of super highbrow figure. And once I read Recovery, it was obvious that he had to be in there, because he was reporting from fringes of experience that I mm-hmm. feel like almost nobody has. Maybe David Foster Wallace in a sort of different way, but he really had that capacity to sort of very beadily observe his own awfulness, because mm-hmm. in lots of ways he's really a pretty awful figure.
Well, one of the reasons also he ends up not being finished, Recovery is an unfinished novel, of course, is because he ends up throwing himself off a bridge.
Yeah, so that, I don't want to sound mocking, I don't feel mocking about him at all, but the sort of hubris of writing a novel about the recovery process is characteristic of the state that he was in at the end of his life, where he'd be talking about, you know, these 10 books that he was writing and how they were all the greatest works. And perhaps they would have been the greatest works. He was that talented. But his ambition and his superficial self-belief were totally undermined by this sense of absolute emptiness, absolute despair. His father killed himself when he was very young, and he felt that very strongly. And the need in the recovery process to just take your guards down was something he found totally impossible. He just couldn't do it. And really, his suicide, I think, is the tragedy of the book, I guess. It's a really painful story.
So John Cheever, the next one to take a brief look at, more famous, certainly more familiar to myself than John Berryman was, but not necessarily more famous to a wider audience. So give us a brief description of who Cheever was.
Cheever is the archetypal New Yorker short story writer. I think, although he wrote 5 novels, he was known for his short stories. Mm-hmm. He's called the Chekhov of the suburbs sometimes, and I think that's a really fair comparison. He wrote these sort of beautiful, really quite surreal and strange, but also very much grounded in this kind of upper-middle-class America. They're always set around drinks parties, and you know, everyone's had a bit too much to drink, and they're both sort of superficially glamorous and quite disturbing. There's lots of sort of people deceiving each other, people not being honest with each other, and they're unbelievably beautiful. His writing, of everybody in the book, he's the most beautiful writer, I think. He's capable of such sort of devastatingly lovely images. Mm-hmm. And he's a really interesting, he's kind of like his own stories. He's not what he appears. He appears like this sort of waspy London gentry type figure. Mm-hmm. He's got this beautiful big house and golden retrievers, and he wears Brooks Brothers tweeds, and he looks the part. And that wasn't who he was at all. He came from a much poorer, more insecure background, and he really created himself as this figure that he wanted to be, but wasn't. And part of that, and the sort of the Cheever tragedy, is that really his desires were for men, maybe not fully, but that was part of what he wanted to be doing. Mm. And he tortured himself about that. He absolutely tormented himself. He was married, he had children. He wrote in his diary at one point, "Every delivery boy, every Comely bank clerk is pointed at my life like a loaded gun." And this is somebody who literally felt like a gun was mm-hmm. pointing at his head throughout his life, so it's hardly wonder he drank so much. And obviously the more he drank, the more poisonous he was to his wife and children, mm-hmm. the more unhappy his family was, the lonelier he felt, the more alienated he felt, etc. Mm-hmm. You just see, and you know, another great diarist, so meters and meters of diaries mm-hmm. that just attest to this isolation and self-destruction.
Of all the people in the book, he's the one that, and it's not necessarily a great finish, but he sort of comes out the other side in some sort of way.
Yeah, he really does. He really, as they say, he hits bottom, but bad. He's teaching up in Boston, is it? Boston? No, it's not. It's Iowa. And he really just basically is on the path to a slow suicide through the bottle. And his brother rescues him and pitches him into this treatment centre in New York, Smithers, which is also where Truman Capote went. And somehow, magically, it does the trick. He manages to get sober. He writes his best novel, Faulkner, after he gets out, which is also about recovery. And the thing with Cheever that's incredible is he really sticks it out. He died of cancer. He got cancer not long after, within 10 years. And his doctors would say to him, "John, you can drink now. I mean, you know, you're going to die." And he'd say, "Well, you know, I think I won't. I think I'd rather go out sober." And that is so moving to me after the sort of pig's ear he'd been making of his life.
I'm Andrew McConnell Stott, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
There's a scene with Cheever and the next person we're going to talk about, Raymond Carver, when they're both teaching at Iowa, carousing and drunk. And Carver, I think, and I'm sure this is unfair, but of all of the six people in the book, was the one that stuck out to me as being, a lot of these people, their bad behaviour was, you know, can be blamed on the alcoholism. Carver, to me, of all of the people, seemed to be the one that was the most of an arsehole, but who could often blame it on the fact that he was drinking as well. It seemed like the drinking came out of the fact that he just seemed like a nasty piece of work anyway.
Yeah, interesting, because the things, I mean, like most people in my generation, you know, I really idolised Carver because of those mm-hmm. stories, and because people always tell you, like, the post-drinking Carver was such a nice guy. Mm-hmm. And reading his first wife's memoir was a real eye-opener, because the things he did were so far beyond the sort of slipperiness that he would talk about. That mm-hmm. at one point he thinks she's looking at another man when they're in the car, and so he stops the car and he beats her head against the sidewalk, and she loses something like 30% of her blood. I mean, it's just this horrific scene. Like you say, he's not a nice guy, and who knows what the sort of second generation, the 2.1 Carver is, but he seems to have pulled together something. But, you know, in a way I wanted to sort of end the book with this, like, and he's a hero and it's all fine. And actually it was much more complicated than that. Sort of reading about his recovery and mm-hmm. reading particularly about how he felt about his children, I ended up feeling like it's a real complicated business, recovery. Mm-hmm. You stop drinking, you recover some things, but you don't necessarily completely change personality. And I think that's probably a better ending, really, for the book than the kind of miracle story, because mm-hmm. there's only so much that it can do.
I've got just a couple more questions. First of all, why these six? Or perhaps not even why these six, but who else, who came after these people? So this archetype that they're setting down, this idea of the writer who drinks, there are lots of people that have been influenced by these six writers, who perhaps you could have chosen over these ones. So who came after?
I guess there's a sort of, I mean, people did come after, but I think it starts to change to drugs then, doesn't it? Like the story of the 70s and 80s, when you're looking at the Beats, say, that immediately starts becoming much more of a druggy story. So somebody like William Burroughs, who I'm fascinated by, it would be a story about heroin. And then I think what we see in our own age is just the whole culture of addiction has changed so dramatically. I don't think the story would be about alcohol at all. I think it would be about pharmaceutical drugs, if anything. It would be about that kind of medication. So, you'd see people like David Foster Wallace coming in there, and he did drink. But we'd have Prozac in the mix, which just, you know, all of these people would have been on Prozac if they'd appeared 50 years later. So I think it's sort of the underlying things, the underlying anxiety, the underlying depression stay constant, but the way that it's medicated and the things that people are drawn to taking just change with time as well.
But they also laid down that, the template, I'm also thinking, of not behavior. Just the drinking, but, well, the behaviour, but also just the ridiculous machoism of so much, the sort of 60s and 70s male writer archetype.
So I mean, you mentioned
Bukowski and Roth and John Updike.
The sort of big swinging dicks type stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's true. But then does that continue to the present day? Like, is that still a... And I guess maybe you see it with people like Martin Amis as well. You know, there's that sort of... I've gone completely blank on what his friend was called, but again, the one who died recently.
Christopher Hitchens.
Yes, Christopher Hitchens.
So, he's been on this show.
Oh, really? Well, yeah, so you see the same sort of relationship with alcohol, I think, there.
Yeah, I mean, certainly with that... Oh, I'll cut this out, because I love Christopher Hitchens, but this whole terrible thing that he talks about in his autobiography, where all of the boys... You know, Ian and Mart, and they would go and get drunk in Soho and do terrible, terrible word games together. And he talks about it in his book as if it's great, as if that was such fun, the best fun you could have. And you read it thinking, oh God, this is awful.
And surely comes from just these people. Yeah, it's surely sort of, to be a writer, you have to live this sort of lifestyle.
That's a good point there, because the last question I want to ask is, I loved the book, I thought it was wonderful, it's beautifully written, and the six great lives, but, you know, they are sordid, bad people. And after I put the book down, I lay there and I tried to think of, I want to write a book which is about six nice, well-adjusted, good citizen writers. Huh. I don't think it's possible. Who would be in that book?
Well... Yeah, no, that's difficult. I mean, maybe you need some women writers in there. I think that Margaret Atwood is probably a good citizen, isn't she? Mm-hmm. Alice Munro is a good citizen. Mm-hmm. But what would be the content of the book? What would they
well,
do?
Well, indeed, exactly. That was the point. You know, what of the story? There isn't a story that exists behind the idea of, oh, yes, they went and spoke at a feminist conference. They did some charity work. It's not the same.
Yeah. And also, I think, you know, with this sort of bit, you're trying to look at something about human experience, aren't you? And I don't want to glamorise drinking in any way, but at the same time, these are people who are really articulating large questions about how we live if we're damaged by our childhoods, or how we live if we've got mental health problems. And they're sort of showing various paths, and I think these are paths that we shouldn't take, but nonetheless, I'm sort of, there they are, they exist to be looked at, and it seems sort of fascinating, but also, like you say, you're really depressive, like, what a waste of a life. And that's the thing that Carver says as he comes out of it is, you know, I've got a second life, and who would have thought it, because I poisoned the first.
Although, of course, you know, he doesn't have much of a second life.
No, he doesn't get long, but he gets 10 years, and, you know, he really made the most of those 10 years.
There is a lovely scene in the end of the book with the graves, I think, Carver and his...
And that was... Yeah, that was amazing. So at Carver's grave, which is a very beautiful place, and it's on a sort of cliff edge with the Pacific Ocean, and there's a bench, and under the bench there's a little box, and in the box there's a Ziploc bag, and you open it and there's a notebook. And people who love Carver's work, but also his grandkids and his widow, go and write in this book, and it was terribly moving, because these would be people who were saying, hey, Ray, you know, like they were talking to a friend, I'm a drunk too, and you're stories give me hope. And, you know, what more do you want from literature, really?
I think that's a poignant point for us to finish. So I'll be talking to Olivia Lang. We'll be talking about her book, The Trip to Echo Spring, on writers and drinking, which is out now in paperback from Canongate. So, Olivia, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, or even a lot, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.